The audible of the best in Bitcoin. This is the Cryptoconomy.
What is up, guys? Welcome back to the show. I'm Guy Swan, the guy who has read more about Bitcoin than anybody else you know, and I hope you are all using Swan Bitcoin. That is Swan with one N. SwanBitcoin.com is the best place to auto DCA. It is the savings, the Bitcoin savings plan that we have needed for a very, very long time. And I'll be dropping a referral link in the show notes. So if you guys want to go check it out and let them know that I sent you, that's how you do that. So today's read is we're back on Bitcoin Magazine. And this one is Pascal Hughley. So we read one by him not too long ago, and this is a great addition to that. So again, this is on BitcoinMagazine.com, written by Pascal Hughley, titled "What is Happening to Money?" What is happening to money? Money. The magical power it has over people is almost universal. But whether we earn it, spend it, or save it, we hardly ever think about the following questions. What is money? Why does it exist? What will money look like in the future? And why should we think too much about it? Our money works. Day in, day out, we use it without much effort. So, what's the problem? As August Friedrich von Hayek pointed out, we humans constantly use things we don't know anything about. For example, you don't need to know anything about the internal combustion engine in order to drive a car. It's no different with money. We don't have to think deeply about money in order to use it successfully. This very fact is what makes us such a successful species and indicates how well our market and knowledge society functions. Given recent developments, more and more people have started pondering the state of today's money. This is indicative of the fact that strange things are happening in the realm of money. What the general public is being told right now is that money can be created ad infinitum. With the coronavirus popping the so-called everything bubble, central banks have been interfering heavily by providing vast amounts of money. In all the different flavors that money or money-like substitutes exist in today's financial world. On top of that, governments have set up stimulus packages in the trillions of dollars, exceeding anything the world has ever seen by far. In the wake of the enormous money tsunami unleashed onto economies and societies, people have begun, rightfully, to start asking the question, what has become of money? Is money even worth anything any longer? A battle of devaluation. Others, among them many Bitcoiners, are asking the question, how has money gotten to this point? In order to answer this question, one has to go back to 1971, when the dollar, as the last national currency, was cut off from gold. Perhaps surprisingly, government currencies did not crash to zero at that time. Rather, they moved to a system of free exchange rates. Whereas the yellow precious metal had previously served as an anchor of value and price, henceforth a battle of national currencies was unleashed. This battle turned out to be quite costly. The different exchange rates of individual currency pairs led to an increase in currency risks. The latter increased transaction costs for international trade, which continue to weigh heavily on global trade to this day, representing a global inefficient barter system on a national currency level. Merchants, companies, and politicians reacted to this situation. Within the political sphere, the US dollar developed into the global unit of account for oil and other commodities due to US hegemony being the strongest economic power around the globe. To this day, the US dollar continues to function as an international reserve currency. In this way, the greenback facilitates global trade, but due to its importance, it also let the US exploit what is called its privilege exorbitant. The sheer dominance of the dollar and the advantages for U.S. markets are impressive. Financialization of the world. The entrepreneurial response has been to financialize the world and create derivatives and more hedge funds. The former are financial products whose primary objective is the contractual hedging of risks over time and space. The latter, hedge funds, are entities that trade in these financial products in the form of actively managed investment funds. It is, therefore, hardly surprising today that hedging transactions to minimize exchange rate risks accounts for a considerable proportion of total financial transactions. Government currencies beget ever greater financialization. It's the entrepreneur's reaction to them. So the ever-increasing number of derivatives used today is ultimately a consequence of the costly effects of this diversity of national currencies. Anyone wishing to send money across national borders today pays hefty fees. The reason? The reality of different currency areas requires the involvement of banking and financial institutions. Countless banks, partner banks, and financial service providers from different countries are involved and want their, quote, fair share. So, ultimately, our current international monetary order resembles a global barter trade based on numerous fiat monies. Legacy systems and regulatory requirements make their efficient and rapid transfer difficult. The various fintech companies of today are therefore also actors in the entrepreneurial reaction to this state of affairs. The most popular and successful among them are those who want to remove artificial barriers in international payment transactions resulting from this global barter. Upstart companies such as TransferWise or Revolut are making possible those things that banks have barely managed to do. Sending and receiving national currencies is not only becoming faster, but also cheaper. Bitcoin, the ultimate reaction. The entrepreneurial reaction in the form of financializing the world has its drawbacks, though. It might help investors, entrepreneurs, and corporations to deal with the hassle of government currencies, but the system at large is being inflated and becomes ever more fragile. Ironically, this is also the reason why we see central banks floating the markets now. They are reacting towards something that has itself been a reaction to central bank national currencies in the first place. The problem is a closed loop that creates an ever greater problem. In 2009, a new player entered the stage, Bitcoin. In a sense, the crypto asset is the final reaction that aims to break this closed loop of national currencies and financialization. Born at the height of the financial crisis, Bitcoin represents the antithesis to the existing financial order. It is an attempt to wrest money as a force influencing the economy, politics, and society from the hands of centrally planned God players. Money again should be scarce and decentralized in order to tame the endless appetite of politicians, functionaries, and economic giants. In the eyes of its supporters, Bitcoin is a counter-reaction to the shameful misuse of fiat money. Whether fiat money is supported by the state and issued by private banks or even corporations, the problem remains the same. It remains in centralized hands, and users cannot keep self-sovereign control of it. Digital payment solutions that promise to turn current money into fiat money 2.0 are merely putting lipstick on a pig, according to the argument of Bitcoin aficionados. This would not solve the fundamental problem of monetary socialism that is ailing our current monetary system. Money is still tied to intermediaries, and every payment made is recorded in a central database controlled by a third party. Transactions can be censored at any time. A real alternative. For this reason, a distinction must be made between digital currencies and cryptocurrencies. The latter can be exclusively controlled by individuals using cryptographic means. So-called cryptographic values can thus be held and used directly by their owners and without intermediaries, similar to bearer instruments or material objects. Instead of being managed by an intermediary, cryptographic values are based on a blockchain. This is a distributed database that nobody has sole control over. A blockchain is ultimately a computer protocol based on programming code. From a technical point of view, this turns the crypto assets into pure information and mathematics. Consequently, Bitcoin stands for an alternative way of thinking about financial systems. Today, our financial system is a conglomerate of abstract constructs, such as contracts, promises, and balance sheets. This bears witness to the fact that our economy has been becoming ever more abstract. Money is no exception. The great philosopher and sociologist George Simmel already noted this tendency toward ever greater abstraction in his work, The Philosophy of Money. There exists a hierarchy of money in today's financial system. Money in the narrower sense, which is also known as base money, and money in a broader, more abstract sense in the form of bank deposits, shadow banking IOUs, credit cards, or mobile payment options. This development toward more abstract forms of money is driven by the financialization of the past decades, which has led to a stronger fusion of the economic and financial worlds. This amalgamate requires a financial alchemy that is now based on three basic building blocks: institutions like technology, incentives, and human participation. In the existing financial system, the human element predominates. Contracts and promises are framed by institutions, but they are executed and enforced by human hands. An uneducated observer might regard Bitcoin as only the latest iteration in this constant evolution toward more abstraction. And although Bitcoin truly is an abstract form of money, it is not a mere extension of this hierarchy of money in a seemingly endless game of financialization. It is a new form of base money, for a new form of network or institution powered by what is today generally called an open, neutral, borderless, censorship-resistant public blockchain. As a new form of base money, Bitcoin will see financialization occur, and with it, ever greater abstraction happening on top of the Bitcoin base money. Interestingly enough, though, on its most fundamental layer, the Bitcoin protocol reduces the human element to an unprecedented extent and gives technology and incentives more weight. Incentives to keep the human element in check and technology are becoming more important due to mathematics, cryptography, and computer science. A financial alchemy as we know it today, but one based on Bitcoin, is likely to depend less on the human element and more on computers, formulas, and code in order to control, execute, and enforce it. It's the hope of Bitcoiners that this sort of financial alchemy will be better in an objective sense than what we have today. The end game is upon us. So let's come back to the question asked in the beginning. What has become of money? Quo vadis, financial system? It seems obvious that our current financial system can only go down this one path. Ever more money is needed to keep it alive. Helicopter money is imminent in the US, another chapter in the tragic but inevitable trajectory of money. Further reading, a link to Zero Interest, Limitless Repo, and QE4, the Federal Reserve's Market Operations Explained. The ultimate chapter will finally be the adoption of what is referred to today as Modern Monetary Theory, or MMT. This theory, which ironically is not modern at all, holds that the state does not need creditors because it can create funds in its own currency at will. As a monetary sovereign, the state is, therefore, not dependent on borrowing on the market in the form of government bonds. It would much rather create the money itself via the central bank incorporated into it. MMT has been growing in popularity, probably because more and more people seem to intuitively feel the inevitable endgame. Other reasons are also more pragmatic. MMT is a blank check for all kinds of political projects, such as jobs, education, or climate protection. Fewer and fewer people are able to resist financial resources for political, quote, necessities. After all, the ultimate aim is to enrich society. Another argument at the heart of MMT is that of justice. Today, bankers and other financial actors seek to enrich themselves in the process of financing of the state, so the argument goes. A few people get richer and richer at the expense of the masses. The fact that MMT wants to end the whole financial circus around interest rates and government bonds by depriving commercial banks of the opportunity to create money is thus met with approval, especially from the political left. The entrepreneurial reaction of financialization will not be made possible anymore. The state will take over all on its own. Debating whether MMT will be more just than today's system really doesn't make any sense in the end. Once money has lost all its meaning, there's no point in debating any justice because there won't be any left. Money will truly be worthless. People will only use it under a state of coercion. In the wake of this coronavirus crisis, the great triumvirate of our day and age, governments, central banks, and banks, has set out to achieve the following: fiat justitia et pereat mundus, or let justice be done, though the world perish. The problem, however, is that in fiat money, there is really no justitia left. Without justice, there is only pereat mundus. So, as an antithesis to endless growth and the meaninglessness of money, Bitcoin stands firm. Its network is limited to 21 million Bitcoin units only. There will never be more Bitcoin. That is the message of it all. And in a world in which relatively scarce money in the form of state fiat currencies will soon only be suitable for lame jokes, such a message is more important than ever. So if Bitcoin didn't exist, it would have to be invented. As a psychological elixir of life, so to speak, it will give comfort and confidence to many more people in the light of the crazy money interventions of our times. What would we do without Bitcoin? This is an op-ed contribution by Pascal Hughley. Views expressed are his own and do not necessarily reflect those of Bitcoin Magazine or BTC Incorporated. All right, that was a great little article. Really love that, and there's a lot that I want to break out of this. The concept around like the financialization and the abstraction of finance is so deeply tied. It's the analogy that explains where this, why I consider Bitcoin a new internet, the internet of money, as Andreas Antonopoulos calls it. So before we get into it, I want to talk a little bit about Swan Bitcoin. So one of the data points that they actually put on the website, which I just thought was really neat, is that if you had put $25 away every week for the last 3 years, it would have cost $3,900. But even through the heart of the bear market, it would have turned into $8,926. What they don't add is that if you had leveraged trade trying to make more Bitcoin, you probably would have turned $3,900 into $0. And who knows what that's going to look like over the next 2 years as we go through the next halving. I think the only smart way to prepare for where we are headed is to DCA into Bitcoin, is to buy weekly, every paycheck, every month, whatever it is, and start a solid, automated Bitcoin savings plan. So go to the show notes, go to the Twitter post, whichever works easier for you, and click on the referral link and let them know that I sent you there, and start your Bitcoin savings plan. Set it once and then you are stacking sats indefinitely. That's how it should be done. And what is happening to all the other money, non-Bitcoin money in the world right now? It's kind of crazy that we got to this point. This was just an awesome article. Pascal actually shot it to me like yesterday, I think. I read it immediately and it was just like, oh, this is easy put on the show here. And the fact that we kind of got, like he says, like towards the end section, is that we are in the end game here of fiat currencies. We are moving as fast as we can go into MMT, which is the inevitable conclusion of kind of the whole Keynesian philosophy to begin with. There's not really any other end game. And it's insane to see a shift so fast that just with the precedent set in 2008, it kind of just broke through the wall of, yeah, governments and central banks should be bailing out to the trillions of dollars. They should be deciding who survives or does not survive a financial crisis. We should deeply politicize everything about finance, which has been going on for a long time, but I think just really got a steroid boost in 2008 and 2009. But as Pascal says, it really did start in 1971. Well, you could argue it went all the way back to 1913, but you know, there's been stages of the decline of our monetary system. But in some ways, I got to be like a little bit impressed, I guess, to say with how well the market, despite the imbalance that it was built on top of, and therefore, you know, the inevitable house of cards that essentially it all was. But how well how many different tools and derivatives and everything have been created literally to try to obfuscate, to abstract away all of this horribly inefficient barter system. We've got this huge Forex market and everybody hedges while people are moving money from A to B, and the way these things are packaged and contracted in order to create this buffer between what is essentially a giant paper money barter system. And that's the way he puts this is just great, because that's really what we've done, is we've taken away the foundation of money. We've taken away the standard with which we can communicate between one money and another. Like the fact that everything was, you know, just measured in gold ounces, and you would just do it in relation to that, it would just be an amount of gold, made it this easy monetary standard that all the fiat monies, I guess they're not fiat until they're off the gold standard technically, but all of these national currencies could all just be translated to a gold weight. And that we lost that the unbelievable efficiency of that system, of not needing these crazy conversions, not needing, in that same way, you wouldn't need all the crazy third parties and all the hedging and all this capital sitting in these hedging markets, these derivative markets, in order to account for changes in that. Like this, it's a whole section of an industry that just doesn't actually need to exist. And there again lies the problem that I think so many just don't see, and for a lot of different reasons, but that they're, even with the dollar as, you know, like, what is it, 60% of global trade, I think it is, happens in dollars, or is dollar denominated. Even with that, it's still a comparison of one bad monetary policy to another, and that all these things are getting bailed out with printed money, and they're bailing out, like a central bank is bailing out another central bank. Like, how crazy is that? It's just the whole thing is so messed up. But you know, it's inherent to, you have these systemic imbalances, and there's no way to, like, all the financialization, all the derivatives, all they can do is obscure the underlying balance. It's trying to calm the waters on the outside of this huge structure that's ready to implode, and essentially trying to make it look like, trying to smooth everything out so that before it does, you know, everything kind of runs decently well. But there's a really inherent, like, systemic problem going on here. This whole article, all it just makes me think of What Has Government Done to Our Money by Murray Rothbard. And I immediately, I'm not even joking, like, since I sat down and read this, I was like, man, I hadn't listened to that one in a while. And I immediately broke it back out. I'll actually link to it on, in the show notes. But Mises.org actually has an audio version of what has government done to our money by Rothbard. So I highly, highly encourage that because it's such an interesting, like it was one of Rothbard's best pieces, which is actually hard to say because he wrote about a billion different things. Another of Rothbard's amazing works. But I, with Pascal's article here, I really like just kind of the framing that we start out with in this article is just talking about how, you know, we don't need to know what kind of the interdependency that we have on the economy, in the economy. The more connected we become, the greater the specialization, right? That the more one person can just do one thing and produce enough value for other people that they essentially outsource all of the other things in their life. Like if I, you know, really good at building a house, I can specialize in just building a house and I don't need to know how to make my food. I can just exchange money for somebody else to do that. I don't need to know how to, wash my clothes necessarily, like hire somebody else to do that. I could hire somebody to make my TV and all my electronic devices and manage my internet connection and, make my oven and cook food and all this great stuff. Like all these other things I can sustain by specializing into one area and knowing how to produce that as efficiently as possible. And the better I am at that one, the more of all of the other things I can afford to outsource to somebody else. But because of that, we inherently have an ignorance about all things that aren't directly related to us. Money being a perfect example is that it's so integrated that it's almost hard to recognize. We don't even see it. It's so prevalent. Best analogy there is just that, you know, a fish doesn't know that it's in water. Water just is. So as long as money works, we don't really have to know anything about it. It's when it starts breaking down that suddenly people have to ask questions and are suddenly wondering what this thing is. And it's funny, we talked about this in the Raleigh Bitcoin meetup a number of times. Steve likes to bring up this topic about how, like, whether or not it's a good thing that we have this increased specialization, that we become increasingly more ignorant or could likely become more ignorant about all of these things that aren't our one specialty. But I don't think that's really naturally the outcome. I think it's more genuinely, I think it's a lot a consequence of our education system is that we kind of have these like seemingly arbitrary divisions and that we're taught things in a, what class of thing is it? Like, is this biology or is this chemistry or is this physics or is this math class or is this English? Like these things are all very segmented. And then kind of the culture of the university system and just, you know, the academia at large becomes, as it becomes more authoritative and it becomes kind of a means to its own ends, like it's a means unto itself, is that to have a good degree, not really because it makes you productive or gives you really good job prospects, but just because, oh my God, look, I killed at academia sort of thing. The more it becomes politicized and the more it becomes its own ends, that it increasingly gets more, what's it called? Competitive, I guess you could say. One professor is like, they do all the physics and stuff in the physics department. And then somebody in history, if they start like coming up with ideas about physics or whatever, it's like, no, don't encroach. This is my territory. It becomes defensive and people like put up walls. Whereas I think in a natural market economy, when you have education based on like projects, you don't just learn biology and just learn chemistry. You learn what of each of those subjects you would need to complete some sort of goal. Because that's how life is, right? We're all goal oriented. We're trying to accomplish something. What are all the pieces of this puzzle? And what are all the different things I need to learn in order to quickly reach the end of my goal as possible? And I think that's where our education system is just gone completely awry, is that we we've completely lost that. None of it is project-based. None of it is goal-based. None of it has anything, hardly anything to do with life or productivity anymore. As soon as you get out of school, you're just like, oh my God, what's my homework? What do I do? You're waiting for someone to give you the assignment to be successful in the world. And hopefully, eventually you learn that there's no such thing. That's just not the way the world works at all. That's school. That was what you wasted the last 20 some odd years of your life doing. And the skill of following instructions, the skill of taking tests is something that you needed 80 years ago when you were working on an assembly line. And not many people do that anymore. That's not the world we live in. And it's probably too long of a discussion to give my thoughts on why I think this is all actually a consequence of our money. The main idea is just that, like Pascal said, is that you don't need to know how to, you don't need to know anything about an internal combustion engine to use a car. And in that same sense, and worsened by all of that disconnectedness in like kind of our education system and academia and like how we separate things that really truly are not separate. We're kind of taught to think with those separations. It leads to a greater specialization and a greater sense of a greater lack of confidence in thinking about things that aren't your quote unquote specialty. So I think it increases all of these divisions, whereas I think in a natural environment, they would probably fall away over time. And you'd have a lot more of the Renaissance man sort of thing where people, you know, would probably specialize in one skill or one area, but seeks out completely seemingly different areas and different subjects to learn more, to have a better perspective to take back to their specialization. And just being adaptive and having a broad understanding of things makes you so much more useful in the market. And people don't realize that. Like knowing, like as a technician or whatever, if I knew the software that like the support, just a general example, it's like, so I was an internet technician, if that wasn't obvious, but like as a technician, the more I learned about like the support software that the people I would talk to on the phone were using, and the better perspective I had for what decisions my managers and team leaders were actually making, like I could preempt problems by knowing what A, my manager is going to have to do, and what B, I should or should not communicate to support. Because of their limited options, I guess, from their perspective. And I could essentially be a buffer between communicating of, you know, different areas and different offices and things when somehow I was stuck in the middle of that. But again, it was only because I specifically went outside of my area of expertise and would constantly bug people on the phone to get me to explain what they were doing. And every once in a while, I'd catch like a support guy or whatever that would actually break it down. They'd get really excited. They'd be like, yeah, I'll tell you how it works. And then like I'd spend 10, 15 minutes on the phone with this guy while he broke me down their software and exactly what they could do and how it worked. Cause I loved it. But anyway, I'm a nerd. I think the key idea here is that I think understanding what a good money is, like being a good shopper, actually makes a more efficient economy. Like to not waste money on something is like, if we can all collectively do that, like not waste as much money and have a broader understanding and a better way to assess, like just knowing a little bit about cars, which I know a handful of things, like I can, you know, replace an alternator or something like that, like do little ish things on as far as mechanics go. But I have the general idea of an internal combustion engine and a lot of car parts, and it saves me a ton of money and waste when I'm going to get something fixed, when I'm deciding or weighing which mechanic to use or which product to buy. And in the context of this is to be able to assess what money I should use. Like, what are the characteristics of a good money? It's this crazy dichotomy, I guess you could say. It's this weird thing that somehow our lack of understanding of money is that quote or whatever, the line that he said in this article, is that the fact that we don't know anything about money is what proves how successful we are as a species, how unbelievably well the market does at accounting for the information and shifting behaviors and operating under ignorance for the vast majority of the people, that it actually works despite that. And that truly is a crazy thing to think that we could be so productive, that we could have so many tools for communication and trade and exchange, that we could all use a tool correctly that we knew nothing about. But somehow we still all end up using the best tool for the job, given the conditions. The economy is just one of the most fascinating things ever. I don't understand. I hate that economics has been dumbed down to such a stupid, simple, like, it's a math problem. It's not. It's such a fucking fascinating, like, organic system that is always shifting. And the fact that it can do so, like, it is a miracle. Just go into a grocery store and look around and think about how much had to go into that for any of it to be possible. Is nobody else just sometimes just flat out amazed that it actually works? I mean, it's damn near a miracle that my computer and the lights are on in my house right now. And I know how to do a lot of that stuff. I know how to I've wired a house before. I know how to put in a fixture, but I don't know shit about making electricity or transporting it 50 miles. Does nobody else find that cool as shit? I don't know. It blows my mind all the time. I can't not. It just pops in my head all the time when I'm looking around at things. I'll just be amazed that something even exists for as ignorant and stupid and stubborn and just assholes that we all are sometimes. That somehow we get past all of that and can still cooperate as a species. I mean, if you just look at the typical Twitter conversation, look at all the stuff that could go wrong. Look at how easily it could not work, and then think about the fact that it does work. I don't know. I'm going too far down this one thread, but anyway, I just think that's crazy all the time. But so back to the financialization. So this is why I think Bitcoin is so profound in how it's going to change things, is because it will be financialized. And that financialization, though, will come without the massive imbalances. Like, again, the last time financialization happened on top of the dollar, on top of these this weird amalgamation of a global fiat barter system, that financialization had an inherent flaw that caused it to essentially multiply and replicate that flaw. It had this systemic virus that was unavoidable. And eventually, like I said, it was just going to build itself out until it imploded, because it's a small imbalance that's persistent at every single layer and exponential things. Gradually, then suddenly, it expands and expands and expands until suddenly there's this giant tipping point, and there we are now. If we don't print $10 trillion, the whole thing's just done. But we're going to get stable, we're going to get sustainable financialization in Bitcoin, that we're going to, and it'll be financialization to not to get across some crazy fiat barter system, but to even out the volatility of Bitcoin, to hedge against mining. Like, I'm so interested in seeing, and I feel like we're not far away from it, but mining derivatives, so that mining institutions can essentially hedge against when mining is profitable versus when mining is not profitable, and actually work through, basically level that volatility out. Because that's exactly what a lot of these tools do. A lot of these derivatives and hedge funds and all this stuff are to level that sort of thing out. And as Bitcoin becomes a new form of base money, I love that line. It's just, Bitcoin is not a new abstraction. It's a perfect competitor at the foundation. It's a new form of base money, which we will build a different economy on. That's what I talk about all the time. That's why I call it the crypto economy, because it's an ecosystem unto itself Bitcoin will be the base money of thousands of derivatives, contracts, everything that we can lock, everything that we can hedge to or a tether to. That we can hash and put on the Bitcoin blockchain. We will do so. And in doing so, we'll have a completely different financial system that has a foundation that can't be cheated. It truly is an entirely new economy. It's an entirely new way to organize a financial system, period. I love the perspective too. What he said is that we've got technology. It was like, okay, so there were institutions and or technologies. All these things basically created the basis of our financialization and our monetary systems, right? So there's institutions and then there's technologies, like kind of as one. And then there's incentives and then there's the human element. And what we have done is we have basically founded the foundation of our system has been based on the human element. It's been subjective. It's been trust-based. It's been a who is more reliable than who sort of system. Kind of the opposite of it's like a whitelisting. Like everybody has to be approved to join, rather than everybody can join by default, and then I will blacklist who I don't want to work with. Because inherently, it only works if you allow honest people into the system. Whereas something like Bitcoin is the opposite; it always works, and you just don't want to do business with dishonest people. Which is obviously far more sustainable and foundationally not as dependent on humans. And that's kind of the idea, is that we've literally flipped the entire thing on its head. Now we've almost eliminated, we've taken as little reliability or dependence on the human element as possible. As he says, to an unprecedented extent, we have removed the human element from it. And created a technology and incentive system, basically a non-human institution, which we can then lean on for the rest of the network. So that at the foundation, the human element is removed. The greed, well, the human element itself is controlled through the incentives in the technology to force cooperation, to force a set of proofs and validation for the foundation of a monetary system. And that's so profound. You know, like that's, it could not be. I really have a hard time. I don't think we'll know for 30 or 40 years to the extent that this will really change things. And we could look back and be like, holy crap, this was bigger than the printing press. You know, like there's so much that could come from this, and the ability to have true information in the market. Think of what, for the market being so good at financializing and trying to cover up an imbalance, for trying to cover up lies, essentially, or bad information, imagine what it can do to make real, like, true information in the market more productive, and to organize it, and that no human can actually manipulate it. Yeah, we can always get, you know, bad branches on the tree, or like nothing's perfect. Like I'm not saying that this is some stupid utopia. It's still made of people. There will still be thieves. There'll still be scammers. Any glance at the crypto space makes it perfectly obvious. It doesn't solve humans. there's no solution to that. We have to, whatever it is, people have to be involved in it. It's no magic wand, obviously. But to solve it at the systemic level is a game changer like no other. And it just seems a bit serendipitous that it's reached the point that it has, when it has, and is present in this environment. And I've heard this now numerous times from numerous different places, but Pascal brings this up as well in this article, just that, you know, while everybody else is going crazy, while every money printer in the world is printing just as fast as it can go, Bitcoin is cutting its inflation rate. and for something where, you know, when somebody starts asking, you know, which one's the better engine when their car is breaking down and this other car is performing better than it ever has. And I think we're going to see that. It's, we live in strange times, but holy crap, what a ride it's going to be. And the next couple of years before 2030, just stuff is going to be different. World is not going to look the same. And how lucky we are to be riding this, as it happens. I'm trying to keep better records of, I'm like keeping like yearly like databases and archives of things that I think are important. Looking back on all this stuff is going to be nuts. I can't believe how many things back in like 2012 and 11 and 13 and stuff I wish I had better records of, because people will just like say like, oh, well, this happened at Bitcoin. I'd be like, no, dude, what? No, no. Are you crazy? That is not at all how it happened. Who the hell told you that? I was there. This is not what happened. And I hate myself for not having better records when something like that happens. Plus, not the greatest of memories. Yeah, this was a wonderful article. Another great one from Pascal. Thank you for shooting it my way. I mean, I've kind of found it on the Bitcoin Magazine anyway, just because I check them daily. And they've got a lot of good articles. I've been kind of fighting with myself on which ones I want to read on the show. Giacomo's part one and part two on privacy, a treatise on Bitcoin and privacy. So good if you guys haven't read it. Maybe if they stop publishing good stuff for a little while, maybe I'll get back to it and put it on the show. But yeah, there's been a lot of great stuff up there. So highly recommend going to check out Bitcoin Magazine. And also, I will link to Pascal's Twitter page so you can go follow him. Massive applause on this piece. What is happening to money? All right, guys, I am out for today. Thank you so much for listening. I am Guy Swan. Don't forget to be stacking sats. Don't forget your Bitcoin savings plan for your future at swanbitcoin.com. Auto buy and auto withdrawal to your keys. Also, they did a Swan signal today with Pierre and Francis on Bitcoin stock to flow and a couple other topics as well. So definitely check that out. Alex should drop that in the show notes as well. So if anybody didn't get to watch it, it's really good. So highly recommended. All right, guys, I love you all. Thank you to my patrons and the Crypto Economy crew. We've had a couple of new guys in recently. I won't say their names for OPSEC, but it's been a blast, and I can't say how grateful I am to have this crew of 46 Bitcoiners to hang out with. It's a lot of fun, and that they're supporting the show and that they care about what we're doing here and why we're here. I don't know. It's just awesome. I found my people. Thank you to all the patrons. And if you want to become a patron yourself, if you want to join the Crypto Economy crew, you can go to patreon.com/thecryptoeconomy. You automatically get the link if you sign up to become a patron. Or also you can just tip me on like tippin.me or over Lightning Network or on the website at thecryptoeconomy.com and shoot me a message, and I'll let you in with all the other crew, because I know some people hate Patreon. Hopefully there's a Lightning solution soon. Not yet, though. Much love to Swan Bitcoin, to the Let's Talk Bitcoin Network, to my lovely patrons, and of course Bitcoin Magazine and Pascal for this amazing article today. And until next time, take it easy, guys.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.